The following episode will contain references to stories and characters that may cause sudden and uncontrollable feelings of nostalgic joy and wonder. Listener discretion is advised.
You know who you are?
Steven is my name.
Even Steven.
Will you say something, Steven?
Steven or else media.
You're listening to another G.I. Joe podcast, and this is episode number one, Operation Lady Doomsday. Hello and welcome to another G.I. Joe podcast, the podcast that's never kidnapped anyone from off a moving train. I mean, not with a balloon anyway. I'm your host, my name is Steven, and I don't know about you, but I am ready to talk about some G.I. Joe. I mean, it's crazy. I've been podcasting off and on since 2006, and though G.I. Joe was the first comic I ever owned and the first comic I ever subscribed to, I've never dedicated an entire show to it, and frankly, kind of fills me with some deep shame. On the other hand, maybe I just wasn't ready to talk about these G.I. Joe comics, at least not in the way that they deserved. That is until now, I guess. I mean, it could go either way. Anyway, today, we're going to be talking about G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, issue number one. This issue sports a cover date of June 1982, but it hit the stands in March. It sold for $1.50, and it contains two stories. The main story is called Operation Lady Doomsday, and the backup tale is called Hot Potato. But we're going to start with Operation Lady Doomsday. This story was written by Larry Hama, penciled by Herb Trimpe, inked by Bob McLeod, the letters were by James Novak, and the colorist was Glynis Ween. Our story begins on a train at 8:30 in the morning, somewhere between New York City and Washington, D.C. On the train is Dr. Adele Burkhart, America's top nuclear physicist, who is traveling to D.C. to testify before Congress due to the fact that she blew the whistle on the military for misleading her into working on a doomsday project. Before she can arrive, however, the train is assaulted by the terrorist organization known as Cobra, and Dr. Burkhart is abducted. Cobra leaves a note behind stating,
"Try to rescue her, and she dies."
Due to all the nuclear secrets the good doctor holds in her head, the military is forced to call in Special Counter-Terrorist Group Delta, codenamed G.I. Joe. Led by Colonel Clayton M. Abernathy, codename Hawk, the Joe team is dispatched to infiltrate Cobra's stronghold, an old Spanish fort located on a small, partially inhabited island in the Caribbean, and to bring Dr. Burkhart back alive. Hawk arrives at G.I. Joe headquarters, calls the team together, and gives them their orders. Grunt, Stalker, and Short Fuse are to take out the airfield, tower, and hangar, but they're to leave one small aircraft intact to act as the team's means of escape. Flash and Breaker's task is to take out the radar station on the island, and then Scarlet and Snake Eyes are to knock out the fort's generator as the assault team, made up of Hawk, Rock and Roll, Clutch, Grand Slam, Steeler, and Zap, storms the fort itself. Stalker's team, on their way through the island's interior, encounters a village and discovers its residents, men, women, and children, the entire village, have been killed by Cobra in order to prevent them from helping the G.I. Joe team. Stalker, wearing the jump jetpack, flies the person he believes to be Dr. Burkhart to safety, but she turns out to be a disguised Baroness. Back in the fort, Cobra Commander reveals to Dr. Burkhart his true plan. The commander had no intention of extracting any information from Burkhart. She was merely bait to lure the Joe team into a trap. When the entire Joe team is inside the fort, Cobra Commander and Burkhart will escape in a waiting helicopter as the commander activates a 5-minute timer that will detonate 5 tons of high explosives, which are buried under the fort, killing everyone on the G.I. Joe team. And so, as the Joes infiltrate the Cobra stronghold, Scarlet and Snake Eyes, already inside after taking out the generator, find Cobra Commander preparing to board the helicopter with Dr. Burkhart. Seeing the two Joes, Cobra Commander uses Dr. Burkhart as a human shield, holding a gun to her head as the door behind Scarlet and Snake Eyes shuts, trapping them with the commander and Dr. Burkhart. The two Joes throw down their guns as Dr. Burkhart shouts out to them that it's a trap.
It's a trap!
And Cobra Commander shuts her up by shooting her. However, despite standing right next to her, he only manages to get her in the arm. Scarlet wounds the commander with a throwing star to the wrist as the rest of the Joe team arrive, blowing open the door and storming in, only to find that he and the Baroness have managed to slip away. Dr. Burkhart tells the Joes all about the bomb, and the Joes, using Cobra Commander's helicopter, fly to safety as the fort explodes beneath them. Aboard the helicopter, Dr. Burkhart thanks the Joes for saving her, feeling that, while all of her political actions were justified, what with the whistleblowing and whatnot, she's glad to know that somewhere in the Pentagon there are people who care. Meanwhile, as the issue ends, Cobra Commander and the Baroness escape the island in an airplane, charting a course to their true headquarters. All right, so before we get into the backup story, Hot Potato, let's talk for a bit about Operation Lady Doomsday. And, I don't know, let's just start with the cover. We got a collection of Joes on the cover firing off their guns at a threat behind the camera. And they've brought along their tank, the MOBAT, or Motorized Battle Tank. Going clockwise, we've got Grunt. He's in the top left corner box. Then on the main part of the cover itself, we have Flash, Hawk, Steeler, Clutch, Scarlet, and Stalker. I think I got them all right. I can't be 100% sure. Let me know. StephenOrElse@gmail.com. That email is in the show notes. This cover is both very generic and highly iconic at the same time. I mean, when I think of the G.I. Joe comic from Marvel, this is the cover I think of. Now, as for the story itself, we're not going to go page by page here with the issue like I tend to do in a lot of my other podcasts, but I do want to point out a few things. First up, we'll call it page one. We get a G.I. Joe weapons profile for the heavy artillery laser, or HAL. This was one of the toys. It was released the same year, 1982, and it came with a Grand Slam action figure. In fact, at that point, that was the only way you could get a Grand Slam action figure, was to get the HAL. The laser cannon itself was pretty cool. You could hook the HAL up to the back of the Vamp, which was the Jeep, and haul it around like a trailer before setting it up to blast some Cobra tail. This was one of the vehicles I owned, and I'll probably point out each vehicle and action figure I owned that are featured in each issue. Of course, I'm not going to repeat myself. I'm not going to continually tell you, hey, there's the tank. I had the tank. Unless, of course, I forgot that I've already told you I had the tank, which will probably happen. As far as the action figures, honestly, I can't be sure which ones from this issue I owned. By this point, we've had just Series 1 of the toy line released to the public, and it consisted of 11 figures that were sold on card by themselves. For the Joes, you had Breaker, Flash, Grunt, Rock and Roll, Short Fuse, Scarlet, Snake Eyes, Stalker, and Zap. And for Cobra, you had the Cobra Soldier and the Cobra Officer. There was also a Cobra Commander, but in that first round, he was only available as a mail-in, meaning, of course, you had to send away for him and get him in the mail. There were also four Joe action figures that came with a vehicle. I've already mentioned Grand Slam, who came with the HAL, but you also had Clutch with the Vamp, which, like I said, was their Jeep that had a wicked double-barrel laser cannon on the back. Hawk came with the MMS, the Mobile Missile System, which is really less of a vehicle and more something that you could wheel around and fire three missiles from. And then Steeler came with the MOBAT, or the Motorized Battle Tank. Now, between my little brother and myself, we had all four of these vehicles, the Vamp, the HAL, the MMS, and even the MOBAT, which was a pretty cool vehicle because it was actually motorized and it would drive forward and junk like that. But
you can make it go left, right, forwards, and backwards.
Damn it, we're not here to talk too much about the toys, though. That shit is going to creep in every now and again. So back to the comic, which has many firsts. Not only do we get the first appearances of all 13 of the original Joes, we get the first appearances of Cobra Commander and the Baroness, as well as the G.I. Joe Command Center, also known as the Pit, which, according to page two of the comic, or the first page of the story, the Pit is top secret armored underground bunkers deep beneath the Army Chaplain's Assistant School at Fort Wadsworth, which is in Staten Island, New York. You know, if you're curious. So for those who may have never read the original Marvel run, especially this first issue, I mean, if you are well-versed in the cartoon, then you might imagine that the comics were much of the same. Cobra, a relatively ineffectual terrorist group, launching ridiculous missions to take over the world using sci-fi-like technology, and the Joes, who are always there to take Cobra down. Each team shooting at each other like crazy, but never actually hitting anyone, just blowing up vehicles while the driver or pilot leaps to safety. I mean, the cartoons were made for kids, right? Well, the comic was a bit different, and it proves that point just 3 pages into the story. Page 4 of the comic itself, on the very last panel of that page, we have the Baroness holding a gun to Dr. Burkhart's head, and she's telling the Secret Service agents who are there to protect Dr. Burkhart,
"I've got your precious Dr. Burkhart now. Back off, or I'll turn her face into a fine red mist."
Which, yeah, compared to the cartoon, that's pretty damn dark. It does get darker, however, and we'll get there, but on the very next page is another moment I want to point out. The Baroness has Dr. Burkhart. They're on the train. They need to get off the train and into the hands of Cobra to be exfiltrated off to their base. So the Baroness pushes Dr. Burkhart into a bathroom, straps a canister to her back, and then pushes her out the window while clinging to her and coming along for the ride. The canister is a gas canister, and as soon as they're out of the train, it bursts open and a great big gas-filled balloon pops out of the top of it, and they start floating into the sky where they meet a Cobra helicopter that drops a line with a hook and pulls them on board. But on this page here where this happens, the very last panel is showing Dr. Burkhart and the Baroness hanging from the balloon being pulled into the helicopter. And I cannot help but wonder why that balloon is not being sucked into the rotors. It's just kind of floating off to the side. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me, and it's one of those kind of wacky things that, despite some very dark moments throughout some of these issues, some really wacky kind of stuff happens at the same time, and not stuff that's meant to be wacky. It's just, I don't know, maybe Larry Hama knows all about helicopters. He did spend some time in the military, and maybe the blades of a helicopter will blow a balloon to the side and not suck it up into the rotors while they're pulling somebody hanging from the balloon into the side of the helicopter. But I don't know. It just does not feel like that's something physically that would actually happen. And the helicopter, by the way, is just a regular military helicopter painted blue with the Cobra sign on it. It was never made into a toy, as far as I know. Page 6, there's a moment here where we meet General Flagg, who is talking to General Austin, and General Austin is telling him about what happened with Dr. Burkhart. And one of the things he tells him is,
"Well, the fan didn't just get hit this time, it got smothered."
And when you consider that what he's talking about is the saying, "The shit has hit the fan," it's kind of gross what he's telling us here, which not only did the shit hit the fan, it got smothered by shit. That's really gross. Another G.I. Joe podcast will return after these messages. Step into the savage world of the Hyborian Age and journey through a land of sorcery, steel, and epic adventure with me, Stephen Orr, on Hither Came Conan. Together, we'll explore the legendary Conan the Barbarian comic series from Marvel Comics, starting with the groundbreaking first issue from 1970 and working our way through each epic tale, one issue at a time. Along the way, I'll also dive into any other Conan comics I can get my hands on. Because when it comes to the titular Sumerian, there's no such thing as too much adventure. Whether you're a diehard Conan fan or just discovering the greatest barbarian of all time, this podcast is your gateway to the blood-soaked battlefields, treacherous kingdoms, and forgotten treasures of Robert E. Howard's timeless creation. New episodes are packed with action, insights, and a little humor, all dedicated to the world of Conan and the creators who brought him to life on the comic book page. So sharpen your swords and subscribe to Hither Came Conan today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. Crom demands it!
Remember, remember, the 5th of November.
The gunpowder treason and plot.
For I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot.
Coming soon to the Magazines and Monsters podcast feed.
A deep dive into one of the best works of Alan Moore's career.
Join me, Billy D., and my co-host, Dr. Ange, as we explore the incredible series,
V for Vendetta.
And now back to another G.I. Joe podcast. Later on the same page, Flag suggests that they just bungle a rescue attempt so that Cobra will follow through on their threat to kill Dr. Burkhart, which, in Flag's view, would solve all of their problems. And this is super cold. I mean, this is our military, right? The American military. Dr. Burkhart was tricked into working on this doomsday device, which they called the Doomsday Project, which was something capable of annihilating all life on the planet. I'm not really 100% sure how she was tricked into doing this. Apparently, she thought she was working on something else, but everything that she was designing or whatever problems she was solving went into the Doomsday Project. And once she found out about it, she basically became a whistleblower. She blew the whistle on the military. Hey, I was hired by the military as a contractor. I thought I was working on designing a better heating system for the barracks, but instead I was creating a doomsday device capable of annihilating all life on the planet. And I think people should know about that. And she was even on her way to testify before Congress. I'm not sure, again, why. I don't know if they wanted to know everything she knew about what was going on with the Doomsday Project, because maybe in general, the Congress, you know, members of the Congress weren't privy to this top secret information. Maybe some were, maybe some weren't, maybe some were part of the project, maybe some weren't. Or maybe she was testifying in front of Congress because she blew the whistle, because she let out state secrets into the public domain. And as far as the military are concerned, she's a traitor. She's a traitor to the American government. And Flag basically here is saying, well, some terrorists kidnapped her. She does have all this information about the Doomsday Project. She does have all this information about our nuclear payload and all our nuclear secrets. She has all that in her head that we don't want to get out. Plus, she's a fucking traitor. How about we just pretend to rescue her? And Cobra then moves forward on their threat and they kill her. And that's really, in the end, that's what we want. And that's some cold-hearted shit, General Flag. Cold-hearted. Again, nothing like the cartoon. General Austin, however, he tells Flag that they cannot let her die and that they have to get her back. Not for any altruistic reasons, not because she's an American citizen or it's the right thing to do, but as he puts it,
we can't let Cobra Commander keep her long enough to use her. And we can't let her die because the whole world knows that we consider her an embarrassment.
So, yeah, I kind of like how Larry Hama really, right off the bat, isn't writing some kind of glory to the good old USA, the red, white, and blue, patriotic, America is the best, and our government and military do no wrong kind of rah-rah bullshit. I mean, Cobra are obviously the bad guys, right? And G.I. Joe are obviously the good guys. But America ain't no land of pristine beauty where all your hopes and dreams come true. And Larry Hama is not afraid to put that into a comic book that was created to sell toys to children. And I think that's pretty great. And it's kind of odd to say this, but so far for a G.I. Joe comic, the world that they inhabit here feels pretty real. So if we move forward, we go to page six of the story. There are a couple of panels I want to point out. The very first panel shows some footage. General Austin is showing General Flag some footage that they have of Cobra. They're having some kind of military-type parade. Cobra Commander is up in this booth looking down upon it. Cobra soldiers are holding flags with the Cobra symbol on it. There's a big, giant tapestry or flag or banner behind Cobra Commander that has the big Cobra symbol on it. They look like Nazis. If it wasn't for the blue uniforms and the Cobra logos, this could be Nazi Germany is what we're looking at. The other panel I want to point out is the very last panel on the page. We see a bank of monitors in which Generals Flagg and Austin have pulled up all of the Joe's dossiers, basically. We see headshots of all of them, their names, and then they have some information next to their headshots that's too small for us to see what they say. But we see all 13 of the original Joes here. Hawk, Grand Slam, Short Fuse, Flash, Grunt, Breaker, Rock and Roll, Zap, Scarlet, Steeler, Clutch, Stalker, and Snake Eyes. But there's a fun little Easter egg here. There's actually a 14th Joe on the monitors. His face is obscured, but his name is shown as Shooter. This is a little inside Marvel joke because, as I said earlier in the episode, the Marvel editor-in-chief at this time was Jim Shooter. Moving forward to page 10, after General Hawk arrives at the pit, the Joes, or at least some of them, are gathered in the training area. And as General Hawk is walking through, he tells them to report to the briefing room in 5 minutes. And Breaker makes a guess at what it's all about, that he feels that they're going to be ordered to rescue Dr. Burkhart because her kidnapping by Cobra is at this point national news. Well, Stalker's there and he has something to say about that.
They're going to risk our butts to rescue a woman who's practically a traitor?
Which, yeah, like I said before, the military thinks of her as a traitor for blowing the whistle on their doomsday project. And I don't think she was. I think she did the right thing by blowing the whistle on it. She did not volunteer to work on that project. She thought she was doing something else, found out that everything that she was doing was being put into this, again, project that could annihilate all life on Earth, and felt that the American people needed to know about it. But Stalker is a military guy like the rest of the Joes, and so he considers her a traitor. On page 11, page 10 of the story, Hawk is giving them the debrief of their mission, and he shows them a picture of Cobra Commander and a picture of the Baroness. He says that the picture of the Cobra Commander he's showing them is the only photo that they have. And it's one of him wearing a hood, which was literally just a blue masked hood that covered his entire head with two little holes cut out for his eyes and a Cobra symbol on the forehead. But as Hawk is showing them these pictures, he says, for example, if Cobra Commander is personally in charge of the operation, the odds against the Joes double. And as for the Baroness, he tells them to never turn their backs on her unless she's dead.
Even then,
he says,
I'd search her for grenades.
So again, much different from the cartoon, where Cobra Commander is often portrayed as slightly incompetent, sometimes even bumbling. But here in the comic, we're led to believe right off the bat that he's a pretty dangerous person, and so is the Baroness.
Cobra Commander is a world-class buffoon.
What?
And before this page is over, just so we know that someone in the military isn't a cold-hearted snake, Hawk is showing on the monitor a picture of Dr. Burkhart, and he's telling the Joes,
we all know this woman. The media painted a pretty black picture of her, but inflammatory headlines help sell newspapers, right?
Well, Short Fuse pops up and says,
Hawk, are you trying to tell me she ain't no traitor?
And Hawk says,
calm down, Short Fuse.
This continues on to the next page, and Hawk gives a little speech.
We each took an oath to defend the Constitution of the United States. That Constitution guarantees the right of every citizen to disagree with the government.
Snake Eyes has something to say about that, but we learn here that Snake Eyes doesn't speak. We don't know why he doesn't speak. They don't explain that to us. He just suddenly starts using sign language. And Scarlet's there with him, so she interprets what he's saying to the rest.
How can the rights of an individual compare to the safety of the entire world? Wouldn't a B-52 bombing raid solve this problem with less risk?
Which, so far, has been the sentiment of pretty much everybody else in the military that have given their opinion. But again, Hawk has something to say about that, and he continues with more of his speech.
No, we're the good guys, remember? The island has a civilian population. Besides, it's not our job to judge Dr. Burkhart.
So yeah, we get this moment here so that we don't think that the Joes are just military puppets who believe everything that the media tells them and are willing to murder this woman because they think she's a traitor. We get Hawk here, who is the voice of reason, and kind of helps us as the reader know that maybe the reason why the Joes think she's a traitor is because of our media coverage of it. You know, that's been a talking point when it comes to politics and media and the military and what to believe and what you can't believe, obviously going back for a long time, because again, this is 1982. If we jump forward to page 14, page 13 of the story, we get the first appearance of the JUMP, or the Jet Propulsion Unit. This is a jetpack, and Stalker wears it to take out some of the Cobra defenses as the Joes take the island. We had that toy as well. I'm going to always say we had it because, again, between my little brother and I, we had a lot of the Joe toys, and I don't remember which one was his and which one was mine. So I'm just going to say we a lot, but we did have this toy and I loved it. It was one of my favorites and I loved making my Joes fly around and blow up shit. As for the rest of the issue, we get a moment or a panel on page 21, page 20 of the story, where we see a Cobra soldier saluting to Cobra Commander, and it appears he is doing the hand in the air Nazi salute. To back up a moment to page 18, 17 of the story, we get a vehicle here called the Hydrofoil LCT, Landing Craft Tank. It's a big hydrofoil ship with a bunch of cannons on it. It almost looks like a U.S. battleship, but it's a hydrofoil. And the only reason I point this out is they're making kind of a big deal of introducing this vehicle. And really, again, the only reason I'm pointing this out is because one might think at the time, based on its spotlight here in this issue, that there was a toy or will be a toy. While there was a Cobra hydrofoil, they never made this into a toy. We see the Vamp in action. That, again, is the G.I. Joe Jeep, which we also owned. That's over on page 22, page 21 of the story. We also see in the panel before that the first appearance of the Ram, which is the G.I. Joe motorcycle. We only see it from the side and not the side that has the cool bit about it. Rock and Roll's jumping over a trench. And yeah, I'll talk about that later. I'll talk about this vehicle later. It is something that we owned, but yeah, I'll talk about it later. There's another moment on that page, last panel, where it appears as if there is a Cobra convoy coming out of the fort with Dr. Burkhart in the back of this car. It is a convertible car. It's an old World War II era type of convertible, and it's got a Cobra flag on the front of it. And again, the Marvel team really working hard to give us this Nazi-like imagery when it comes to Cobra. On page 27, page 26 of the story, we see Scarlet take one of the throwing stars that are located on her wrist beneath her palm. These were part of the action figure. I mean, they weren't removable, but she had these stars on her wrist and her forearm. And I had always assumed as a kid that they were throwing stars, but it's nice to see her actually use them here. And then Cobra Commander and the Baroness escape. The Joes escape. The fort blows up. And Dr. Burkhart tells the Joes that it's good to know that somewhere in the Pentagon that there are people who care. And I don't know that there's many, Dr. Burkhart, maybe just General Austin. And then, of course, as the issue ends, we have the Baroness and Cobra Commander flying away in the plane. And Cobra Commander's not piloting himself because he got hit in the arm with Scarlet's throwing star. So he's injured. So he asks the Baroness to take the stick. And she asks if she should plot a course for their true headquarters, which, very mysterious, folks. The issue ends with us going, wait a minute, this wasn't Cobra's real headquarters? This was all just a trap? Really? That's all it was? Where is Cobra's real headquarters, and what might they have in mind for G.I. Joe in the future? Great ending to the story. And so, yeah, I quite enjoyed this story. I've read it a number of times. I've read this issue a number of times. But while I first started reading G.I. Joe in 1984 with issue number 25, it was a number of years later before I was able to get my hands on this issue and get it read. And I have to say, I'm still taken aback by this issue. I mean, or at least this story, because by the time I got around to reading the issue for the first time, which was sometime in 91 or 92, the cartoon was over. And Frankly, despite having been reading G.I. Joe comics for nearly a decade, the bit in this story where we learn that Cobra Commander sent his troopers into that village to kill everyone there, the men, the women, and the children, simply to prevent the possibility that they might help the Joes. I mean, yeah, I still get chills because Larry Hama wasn't f***ing around here. I mean, come on. Again, this is a comic book based on a toy line for children. Okay? Children. I was 10 years old when the toys and this issue hit the shelves, and I was within their target age group. I just can't believe that Hasbro let Marvel get away with Cobra slaughtering an entire village of people. And I'd like to say that they don't show it. And really, they don't. I mean, they don't show the act. They don't show the soldiers going in and gunning down innocent people. But they sure as hell show the aftermath. Another G.I. Joe podcast will return after these messages.
A long time ago, in a comic book rack far, far away. During the years between The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, Marvel Comics kept the Star Wars magic alive, delivering bold new stories, expanding the mythology, and taking our favorite heroes and villains on unforgettable adventures. Now join me, the irredeemable Shag, and an ever-changing roster of guest hosts as we journey back to this incredible era. We begin with a comic adaptation of The Empire Strikes Back and continue through the thrilling tales leading up to Return of the Jedi. If you're a seasoned Star Wars veteran who knows your Shira Bree from your hoojibs, or a brave explorer venturing into these comics for the first time, this is your hyperspace lane to classic Star Wars adventure. Join us for Marvel Star Wars, From Empire to Jedi, every other month on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Beginning in June 2025.
Are you looking for a podcast that dives into the very beginnings of the Man of Steel? Then check out the Superman Super Show. My name is Steven, and along with Ed Moore, we're just a couple of guys separated by 1,000 miles of geography who like to read comics. Now, we don't claim to be experts on Superman or the Golden Age of comics, but we're on a mission to read every single Superman story from his earliest adventures, one comic book at a time. In each episode, we'll take you back to the Golden Age, where Superman's journey began. From his first leaps over tall buildings to battling mad scientists and mobsters, we break down every story, sharing our thoughts, insights, and laughs along the way. New episodes drop every 2 weeks. So whether you're a longtime Superman fan or just curious about his roots, we invite you to join us on this incredible journey through comic book history. Find the Superman Super Show wherever you listen to podcasts and start exploring the Golden Age of Superman with us today.
And now back to another G.I. Joe podcast. On page 23... Page 22 of the story, the very first panel, as Stalker and his team walk into the village, we see no less than 8 corpses on the ground. And along with that, in the background, we see what appears to be a small pile of corpses. That's some dark shit, folks. Dark, dark shit for, again, I can't emphasize this enough, a comic book based on a toy that was aimed at children ages 5 and up. I looked it up. I looked at the original action figure packaging, and it says for ages 5 and up. That's just crazy. That's just crazy for them to show that in this comic book. I mean, there are many panels in this issue that show the Joes throwing down with the Cobra soldiers, and the Cobra guys are getting shot, and they're dropping like flies. It's not graphic, not at all. In fact, you could even say that the ultimate fate of each of those soldiers that get shot, we're not really clear on. They may have survived. They just may be stunned. We don't know. But the villagers, yeah, they died. We see that front and center. They are dead. Men, women, and children. And that just shows us, Larry Hama, I guess, is using that to show us that there is no doubt that Cobra Commander is someone you do not want to mess with. I mean, there's also a moment during the Joe's initial assault of the island, when three of the Cobra soldiers, who all appear to be wounded, report to Cobra Commander that they were not able to stop the Joes. And you almost expect one of those moments where the evil leader, angered over the failure of his soldiers, lashes out and kills the three of them. But no, not Cobra Commander. Instead of killing them, he's just like,
I hadn't actually expected any of you to survive. This Joe team is less efficient than I thought.
Meaning that, yeah, he was angry. Actually, I don't even know that he was angry. I think he's just more disappointed that the Joes hadn't killed all of his soldiers that Cobra Commander had sent to their deaths. And yeah, I know that eventually this comic does start to lean towards some of the more silly sci-fi aspect of the toys. And even at one point, the comic goes ninja crazy. But here at the outset, this was a serious military comic with serious people, serious situations, and serious consequences. It's like Marvel said, fuck the toy line, and Hasbro, just let them get away with it. And I think that is amazing. Now, as far as the art for this story, Herb Trimpe and Bob McLeod, I loved it. It's not flashy, but it does the job, and it does the job well. Not once was I confused about what was going on from panel to panel, and everything just looked great. There's a sense of realism to the art without it feeling wooden or stilted, and it was just great. I loved it. What about you? Did you like this story? Did you like the art? Send an email to StephenOrElse@gmail.com and tell me what you thought. Just make sure you put G.I. Joe number one in the subject line. And again, that email address will be in the show notes. Now, before we get to the backup story, after the main story, we get a double-page spread of the pit. It's a cross-section showing all five levels with the floor plans of each individual level included. And I love it. I love this kind of stuff. It makes for a more immersive experience knowing stuff like the Joe's living quarters are on level four, and the training area and the pool are on level three, and the briefing room is on level two. I mean, I don't know if comics still do stuff like this, but if they don't, they should. Following that in the issue is our backup story, Hot Potato. This was written by Larry Hama, penciled by Don Perlin, inked by Jack Abel. The letters were by Rick Parker, and the colorist was Glynis Ween. Somewhere in the Middle East, Scarlet, Snake Eyes, and Rock and Roll have been sent to infiltrate a Cobra-funded military group called the Guardians of Paradise. They're to steal a tape which contains information that could bring down the Guardians of Paradise and their leader, Colonel Sharif. Hawk, Stalker, and Breaker, dressed as locals, wait for the three in a nearby cafe. Based on their conversation, it's made apparent that the lives of the three Joes mean nothing compared to the U.S. getting their hands on that tape. Meanwhile, Scarlet, the leader of the mission, finds herself, along with their team, Snake Eyes and Rock and Roll, beset by the Guardians of Paradise. There's been a shootout, and while many of the Guardians lie dead around the three Joes, Scarlet has been wounded. She orders the two to leave her and take the tape to Hawk, but Rock and Roll refuses to leave anyone behind. It's not until Scarlet orders Snake Eyes to force Rock and Roll to leave with the tape by threat of being shot. And as Rock and Roll takes the tape and hands over his weapons and gear, Scarlet pulls her gun on Snake Eyes and orders him to go with Rock and Roll. The two leave her and make their way across the desert. As they reach the halfway point between Scarlet and Hawk, Snake Eyes disappears, leaving Rock and Roll all alone and super pissed. Snake Eyes, it seems, has doubled back to help Scarlet, figuring that Rock and Roll would follow orders. He arrives as Scarlet, using Rock and Roll's M60 heavy machine gun to shoot down the Guardians as they try to advance on her position. She doesn't see, however, the two creeping up from behind. Snake Eyes takes them out and joins Scarlet, who is so happy to see him, she sheds a couple of tears. Back at the cafe, Hawk, Stalker, and Breaker are eating a meal, worrying over their late teammates when something comes crashing through the window next to them. Thinking that it's a grenade, they dive for cover, only to discover that it's a rock with a small package tied to it. Inside the package is the tape. Rock and Roll, to complete his mission, tossed the rock with the tape into the cafe, knowing that Hawk would get it, then took the Joe motorcycle, racing back into the desert. He arrives to help Scarlet and Snake Eyes just as they have run out of ammo. The three race away on the motorcycle and soon find themselves being strafed by a jet, which is quickly blown out of the sky when Hawk arrives in the Jeep. Surprised to see him, Scarlet asks where the tape is. Hawk tells them that the tape is with Stalker, who should be on a commercial airliner halfway to Gibraltar by now. As the story ends, Stalker in his civilian clothes is aboard the plane, ordering his in-flight meal, his hand resting on an attaché case. Okay, so the title of the story, Hot Potato, refers to the tape. Whoever has it, their job is to get it out of the country, and they pass it around like a hot potato. Scarlet's mission was to get the tape to Hawk. Hawk's ultimate mission was to ensure that the tape gets back to the U.S. Scarlet, once she realizes that since she's wounded, she's only going to slow the team down, passes the hot potato to Rock and Roll so that he can get it to Hawk. Rock and Roll, who'd rather stay and either get his teammate out alive or die with her, passes the hot potato off to Hawk, who then passes it on to Stalker so that he, Hawk, can get out there to Sharif's emirate, pull his people out, and get them to safety. Stalker, well, as he's ordering his in-flight meal, the flight attendant asks him what he wants with his steak, and he says,
"A potato. Make it hot. Real hot."
Which, I guess, is supposed to be funny, but it's not. So this story is all about doing your duty, even if it means sacrificing the lives of your teammates and even yourself. I mean, there's a moment when Scarlet and Snake Eyes run out of ammo that Scarlet tells him she has 2 rounds left in her backup, which is a little handgun attached to her forearm, and she suggests that they use those rounds on themselves rather than be captured. And I'm like, damn, this is one dark comic that's based on a toy line for children ages 5 and up. It really is. But all in all, it was a good little story, though I'm not really a big fan of Don Perlin as penciler. He's really good at facial expressions. I mean, these characters do really emote. But the problem I really have with them is, well, Scarlet, for example, doesn't always look like she has the same face panel to panel. And I don't know. Don't get me wrong. Perlin's not bad at what he does. It's just that what he does isn't really for me. I don't know. It's hard to explain, but I just don't like it. And really, I don't have anything to say about the story except to point out the use of the Ram or Rapid Fire motorcycle. This is the motorcycle that Rock and Roll drove back into the desert. It's called Rapid Fire because attached to the side of the motorcycle is a sidecar. But instead of it being the type of sidecar that a passenger could ride in, it's instead a Vulcan 20mm Gatling cannon with a wheel underneath it that the driver of the motorcycle can fire. Of course, the cannon doesn't swivel up and down or left and right or anything like that. It only fires forward, and so fires at whatever the motorcycle is pointing at. But it was my single favorite G.I. Joe toy. Forget what I said earlier about the jump jetpack. The Ram is my favorite. And if I remember correctly, on the toy, the sidecar Gatling gun was removable, which meant that you could play with the motorcycle without the gun if you wanted to. And the motorcycle itself was super badass looking. It was olive green, you know, military green. And there was like this, I don't know what you'd call it, a canopy maybe that covered the hand grips, which gave it this cool, slick look that I just freaking love. I loved this motorcycle. And it has a nice little moment in the first episode of the Mass Device 5-episode cartoon miniseries, which shows Stalker riding it. He jumps a ramp and he leaps from the bike and he lets it crash into something to create a diversion. And it was super cool. So following the backup, there are 6 additional pages. 4 of them are character files: Scarlet, Breaker, Flash, and Stalker. The 5th page is a weapons profile on the Vamp, or vehicle attack / multipurpose. That was the name of the Jeep Vamp. So yeah, knowing that it was called the Vamp, if you just heard that Vamp, you wouldn't know what it was. Knowing that Vamp stood for vehicle : attack / multipurpose, you still wouldn't know what it was. But on the 6th page there of the last 6 pages is a weapons profile on the Mobat, the tank. And I would like to start doing a spotlight on the various characters at the ends of certain episodes, you know, share the character file, talk about things about the characters, stuff that I like. But maybe we'll save that for next week. We'll see. But yeah, that's all I have to say about G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, issue number 1. What about you? Anything you'd like to add? Anything I left out? Any fun facts that I may have missed? Email me at StephenRLs@gmail.com, and who knows, maybe I'll read it out in a future episode. In our next episode, a small Joe team is sent to the North Pole to investigate an attack on an American research station. But when an Inuit mercenary arrives on the scene, will the Joes find themselves outwitted and outmatched? That's coming up on episode 2 as we take a look at G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, number 2, Panic at the North Pole, published by Marvel Comics in May of 1982. So until next time, folks, my name is Steven, and this is another G.I. Joe podcast. Thanks for listening. Bye. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of another G.I. Joe podcast. Questions and comments can be directed to StephenOrElse@gmail.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can help to boost our presence online by leaving a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. I also invite you to join our subscription program, Stephen or Else Beyond. And in return, you'll get episodes of another G.I. Joe podcast early and ad-free. Check out the link in the show notes or just go to beyond.stephenorelse.com to sign up today. Another G.I. Joe podcast is a presentation of Stephen or Else Media. For more nerdy content hosted by me, check out somanypodcasts.com. All links will be in the show notes. It was written by Larry Hama, penciled by Herb Trimpe, inked by Bob McLeod. Ugh. It was written by Larry Hama, penciled by Herb Trimpe, inked by Bob McLeod, lettered by... Before she can arrive, however, the train is assaulted by the terrorist Man, having a tough time talking. Flash and Breaker's task is to take out the radar station on the island. And then... The pit is secret... The pit is top secret. Tell you what, folks. Usually when I get in these kind of situations, I just can't say the thing that I'm supposed to say over and over and over. It just keeps coming out wrong. Time to take a drink. Take a drink, folks. Here we go. Ice coffee. You just can't beat it. So for those who may never have read the original Marvel run. Oh, Jesus Christ. I can't even see it. Marvel run. So I'm thinking Marvel and run at the same time. So it comes out Marvel run. Let's try it again. All right. I've got your precious Dr. Burkhart now. Wouldn't a B-52 bombing raid? B-52's love shack is a little old place where we can get together.
I just don't think I can move through life knowing that a guy named Steven did this to me.
How could you let this happen, Steven?
Steven, thank God. I had a horrible feeling I was going to be the only one here.
You were saying
G.I. Joe.